What was the largest column you made?
Those first ones were 6 foot, then we went to 8 foot, and then to 10 foot. All was the same very heavy weight material, so that, as I've often thought, that in we built first one building, then another building, unlike modern columns, and since these were so expensive because of the copper as compared to steel stills that you use for petroleum, and because they were relatively small, and we followed the old practice of the alcohol distilleries in always housing them rather than building them out in the open. There was also a few extra pieces of equipment that could well have been put outside, but were not. And so we built a beautiful building, probably 70 feet high, for these first four columns, and then space where I think two additional 8 foot columns were placed. Then later 10 foot columns in a second building. But the point is, I have often thought and felt that there was no other place in industry, no other place in the world, where there would ever be as many tons of copper as in these tremendously heavy stills, which I believe are still operating. Yes, I believe they're still operating. They should be. They're made so heavy. And the copper is not corroded if you can keep the air out. And so if the still just keeps operating, we use some precautions, of course. But anyway, one little incident. Of course, the first program, the second program, I mean, once Eastman got into the cellulose acetate for their safety film, they then, meanwhile, had been getting into the experimental development program to make fiber. So they got into that. Then they got into it for making sheeting, take the place of cellophane, a somewhat preferred, had disadvantages there, too much static. Well, I don't know. That may or may not be the reason the acetate film has never been competitive with cellophane. Of course, it's more expensive, but it wouldn't be nearly as expensive as mylar film, the polyester film. But anyway, one little incident about Kodak had developed a great skill in fabricating copper, they were able to welded copper. Very few people welded copper, but in the Kodak Park shops, that technique and skill had been developed. They also did various other fabrications. I was concerned with very big heat exchangers that were being built there in Kodak Park for heat exchanging of the gas vapor mixture which came off the coating machines that made the film, and those things were so large, and they were made in the shops then in Rochester. I don't think there was anything except their enormous size. There was certainly nothing patentable about them. But instead of measuring the heat transfer surface by square feet, those actually had acres of heat transfer surface that were made there. But getting back. The copperware was all done. Work was all done in the shops in Kingsport. We even made our own nuts and bolts. We made for clamping the plates together. We made these 1-inch studs. We made these 1-inch studs, and there were dozens of tons of these bolts long enough to hold the very heavy backing flanges and so on. But the tremendous conservatism has always impressed me. And of course, Kodak was in business and is in business to stay a long time. And if those columns are still running, that was worthwhile. The second one, these distilling buildings, I remember so well. Had a little, we changed and modified, simplified the process a little bit, and we didn't have quite the condenser arrangement at the tops of the columns, and so that while this first brick building, 70 feet or so high, had a on the roof, probably for one third of its area, a glass house build up, glass walls with windows that could be lifted as the usual structural window in a factory structure is built. And in the new building, which then was built adjacent, we didn't need that because that superstructure or doghouse, as we called it, on the roof, because we didn't have the same volume or the same nuisance of taking care of the condensers. Mr. James White, Jim White, was the manager of the plant. He had come into the business from the wood distilling days up in Michigan and was a tough but awfully decent guy to work with, and he looked over our blueprints of the new building, which was then we had the other building alongside a perspective to see what it looked like. He said, "Hey boys, you don't have a doghouse on the roof." "No, we changed the price a little, don't need it, and we figured we'd save some thousands of dollars by not putting it on." "Is that important?" "Oh, maybe 5% of the cost or so." "Well," he says, "put it on. Symmetry." He says, "You know, God still puts tits on boars, even though they may not be necessary." Well, obviously that was built. That doghouse reminds me of another interesting incident that happened when I wasn't, I wasn't there, as I spent about half time in Kingsport and half time in Rochester. But something went wrong. I forget now what the incident was, but the still house was a building maybe 70, 75 or 80 feet high, and 50 feet by 75 feet or 100 long, but a tower, and it had quite a stack action because of the heat of the distilling towers and so on. So under normal conditions, and since heat wasn't as expensive then as it is now, these windows on the doghouse were open. Well, something went wrong one time, and a large amount of acetic acid escaped, or they had a spill. Anyway, and the stack action brought these vapors, these excruciatingly irritating of these strong acetic acid. Came up, and the operators all fled to the roof. They kept they got up there, and stairways. There was no elevator in this building, and a couple of the operators were up in their room, and they fell down. They were exhausted, and this and the windows open over them, just let the stuff. And this one guy was lying there, and another guy came along and saw what was happening, and he was moaning and moaning, and he dropped the window down so that the the fumes didn't come up, and the wind took them away. And this guy turns around, thanks God. Another bad indication of the preciseness, the nicety of many things at Eastman. We had lawns all around these buildings. This was we still had the old wood distilling plant on the other side, because the plant had originally started out from being a wood distillery, charcoal production. And we another bad spill. I happened to be there, although this happened at night. I wasn't on the job. But a 3-inch stainless steel pipe was carrying acetic acid, and it was just in those days that we were learning how to weld stainless steel. Stainless steel now is adjusted in its metal content so that it does not need its crystallization takes place satisfactorily after a welding process without crystal formations which are brittle. A very clumsy way of stating it. But that hadn't been learned, and stainless steel should at that time have been annealed, but you couldn't anneal pipes that are welded in place in the plant. And this 3-inch pipe broke and poured 1,000 gallons of not of the strongest acetic, but of the 28%, and that ran out of the big doorway for bringing in equipment, and killed all the grass for a quarter of an acre outside there. Fortunately, nobody was injured. And they got shut it off and made whatever repairs to the pipe, put some flanges on, I suppose, instead of welding. But the next day, the morning I got down there already, this happened about 2 in the morning, the morning when I got down there, they were already digging up the grass, and within 2 days that was all sodded with new grass. Now, this was in a factory building, and this was a beautiful complex of new buildings, making cellulose acetate. Everything has to be spick and span, nothing like the clean rooms that you have to have for making Kodak film. There you have to have super dust-free and cleanliness. But this was very nice. On the other side of the road was the wood distillery, which is tar and dirt and cinders and charcoal and so on, an entirely different thing, but that illustrates so well that different types of operations, you have to have different types of cleanliness, of tidiness, of housekeeping, and so on, depending your operation. Obviously, a cement plant can't be as dust-free as a packing plant, the packing house, or so on, although the smells are better. I might divert. This is interesting history of chemistry and chemical industry. After the First World War, the expansion of the Kodak operations was considerable. And in the making of Kodak film, the nitrocellulose film, and then, of course, also the acetate film, you require solvents. And the solvents are alcohol, wood alcohol, that is, wood alcohol or methanol, and acetone. And those two things came entirely from the destructive distillation of wood. When you distill wood, or bake it in an oven, probably be a better way to say it, you get a smoke coming off, and that smoke, if you can call it that, it has a large amount of water, obviously, from the decomposition of the cellulose and whatever free water is there, Also, then alcohol, acetic acid, and you get a pyrolysis and a lot of tars. Anyway, when you condense what can be condensed out of this smoke, it is called pyroligneous acid. That's about 8% acetic, as I mentioned before, and 2 or 3% wood alcohol. The acetic acid in the old days had more of a market because it could be converted into acetone. I won't go into that. But anyway, in 1920, which was not the height of a boom business or by any means, but anyway, Eastman, Mr. Eastman, and the directors decided that they had to go about having their own source of supply of the wood alcohol and the acetone. And so they set out to investigate. During the First World War, dozens of wood distilleries had developed to make these two materials so they could be used in making smokeless powder or cordite. And in southern New York State and northern Pennsylvania, that industry flourished during the First World War. The man that was given the job by Mr. Eastman of looking into this was a man whose name I mentioned before, Wilcox, Percy Wilcox. And Wilcox looked the country over. He looked at one plant just 100 miles south of Rochester, northern Pennsylvania, the Gray Chemical Company. And that had many advantages, including the proximity to Rochester. The scuttlebutt was, however, that he didn't want to be so close to Rochester. He wanted to set up his own empire, and it turned out that was wise. So the place he decided to settle and to buy the plant, and Mr. Eastman went down, and with him they negotiated to buy this plant in Tennessee, Kingsport, Tennessee, which was almost three times the size of the one, I guess three times the size of the one in Rochester, in northern Pennsylvania.
Do you recall where, I come from northern Pennsylvania, I'm curious where this great chemical company was in northern Pennsylvania?
It was in a little town called Rowlett. Rowlett is on Route 6. It's 8 miles west of Cowdersport. Did you ever hear of Cowdersport? Mm-hmm. Huh! Well, I could spend 2 hours telling you about that. I'll come to that only gradually. So they built this plant in Kingsport and devised some new system of carbonizing wood, which turned out to be a failure, but which then became the background for the development during the from the early 20s till the late 20s when cellulose acetate came into the picture. We'll say the desire to make it was in the middle 20s, and then the Kodak actually did get into business by 30. And one of the important steps was, as I said, the recovery of the acetic acid. As a mark of a matter of chemical industry, at the time of the late 20s, this interesting historical fact, Eastman wanted acetic acid to make cellulose acetate. Acetic acid is also used in a very pure form. We call that the glacial form. That's the 99.5% acetic acid. It's called glacial because it freezes at room temperature, a low room temperature, 16 degrees. So, and incidentally, that's the way it is. That is the way you analyze it. You analyze it because the freezing point goes down for every percent or so of water. It'll go down 4 or 5 degrees in freezing point. No, Yes, goes down. Goes down. The freezing point of the dilute acid is, of course, much lower than the freezing point of the anhydrous material. Well, why did I get off on that? I was talking about, oh, yes, yes indeed. Kodak sold for photographic use a large amount. They sell it in small bottles to photographers for acidifying some baths or so on that was used. They sold that as part of their photographic chemicals. And that was made at a wood distillery in northern Michigan, at Iron Mountain, Michigan. And they had to buy this in carboys of glass because that was before aluminum was used. And aluminum is good for shipping acetic acid, but aluminum wasn't available early on for that purpose. And so they had to ship in carboys of glass, freight cars of them, in the fall or in the summertime, so that they wouldn't freeze, and then had to store them themselves, so that there was a tremendous number of these carboys in wooden crates packed with Excelsior around them and so on, that had to be stored. So they were buying acetic acid from Iron Mountain, Michigan, up on the upper peninsula, distance maybe of 1,500 miles or so by train, to bring it to Rochester. They were then making 28% acid in their experimental production for cellulose acetate, which was on a tonnage basis, but at the time I came to Kodak in the 27, they had no means to recover this 28%. The only thing they could do with it was ship it to Dow Chemical in Midland, Michigan, another 800 or 900 miles. So they would ship 28% acid to Midland, Michigan. There, Midland, Michigan would convert it to acetic anhydride, ship it back to Rochester, where they would use the acetic anhydride to make the cellulose acetate. Meanwhile, Kingsport, down there 700 or 800 miles south of Rochester, met merrily on its way, turning out tons and tons of acetic acid, which they neutralized to calcium acetate and shipped to Everett, which is outside of Boston, Massachusetts, where they in turn were making acetic acid. That was the New England Chemical Company, which later became Monsanto. But here, the you can see that in 27, when they hired me, I mean, it happened to be the same date, but when I was hired, they had this problem of how the hell we going to cut all these freight bills and so on. Well, of course, what ultimately happened is everything was localized in Kingsport, and we developed the anhydride processing and so on, so they made the anhydride down there, and then recovered their own acetic acid and so on. But that was only a small amount of acetic acid they got from their wood distilling operation. They had to get it otherwise, and so on. Well, that's that.
Fascinating.
Let me say one other thing. We were talking about my education. I had occasion to write to Badger, Professor Badger, about December or so, or maybe not. Oh no, it was earlier in the fall than that, of 27. And I said, he'd asked me what he'd written me about something, asked me how I liked my job, I guess. And I told him I liked it very much. It was so many new things to think about. And I said, I learned much more in these 3 months That was it. So it was only in September, October. I learned much more in these 3 months here than I did in the 3 years I was working with you. And he wrote back, "Well, damn it all, I expected you would. If I hadn't trained you so well, you wouldn't have."
The other thing I have here that you did at Kodak was extractive distillation, which fits in, I guess, what you've been talking about. I have a date here of 1929, separating acetone and methanol.
Oh, yeah. I was supposedly 100% on acetic acid. Sometimes I was called in by some other departments for help. Our distilling department was huge, big distilling equipment, and it was extremely inefficient. The man who ran it was a man who had been hired by Mr. Eastman in 1899. And this, of course, was, we'll say now, in 1929, so it was 30 years. He was getting along in his years and perfectly satisfied bossing a crew of men, but he didn't even really, he didn't understand what vapor pressure was, much less anything about the theory or practice of separating things by distillation. So from time to time I was called in. One of the jobs that I was called in was developing a system by using my azeotropic technique that I had worked on for separating vast amounts of butanol from water. Butanol the C4 alcohol, was used to dry the nitrate. After you took off the water, was centrifuged off the water, your nitrate, in order to dry it, you obviously couldn't put it in a toaster to eliminate the water. So it was washed with butanol, which then was allowed to evaporate because the butanol had a sufficient solubility for water, but no solubility for the nitrate. Anyway, there were tremendous amounts of this butanol that was then distilled to get rid of the water. And it's the simple thing about the azeotropic distillation technique I had developed was that when you add a material to water that is soluble or substantially insoluble, and water and butanol are not very soluble, so they act as though they were insoluble in this case. When you distill them over the head of the column at the low boiling point, you condense, and then since water and this entrainer is insoluble, you have a decanter, and that decanter allows the two liquid layers to separate. Well, of course, you couldn't separate the vapor layer. So therefore, your water layer, it goes to one column, your entrainer layer, in the case of the acetic acid, would go back to pick up more water and entrain more water. And in the case of the butanol, which I applied this technique there, and they, of course, had never thought of it. Well, it was a relatively unknown technique. But anyway, they had let the butanol stand and settle sometimes for weeks, so they had tremendous tankage of butanol, and by this simple technique with less heat than they had been using for distilling, they eliminated this. The other separation, however, or one other separation that I'd been called in, was the separation of the acetone and methanol. Acetone and methanol form a constant boiling point, which is very difficult to eliminate in any separation process. However, acetone and methanol are both completely soluble in water, but on the other hand, the methanol is so much more like water and it has so much more affinity to water than acetone does, that if you had a distilling column and were pour water in the top of the column, it would tend to let the acetone go over the top and dissolve the methanol and take it to the bottom. That is not very good system, but if you